open right now. Why? Because we're hanging here. It's a Monday morning. I know what you're thinking. You're looking at your calendar and you're going, wait, why is this? It's Monday morning. It's not Sunday evening. That's right. But again, this is a special edition of The Edge. They got me up early in the morning, and it's really hard to do this with comedians. Usually we don't even hit. You know, our morning is like somewhere about 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and then we get ready for that 1 hour of work a night. So it's really good to be up and alive and doing what we do. Again, this is the special edition of The Edge. And today, my special guest, they're doing so much time everywhere. Everywhere I turn, I see these guys. They're out there with their book. It's Gratitude and Trust. 6 affirmations that will change your life. It's a Grammy Award winner and writer, comedy writer, Tracy Jackson and Paul Williams. Give it up, everybody. How are you guys doing? Yes, you can do it for yourself because this is a closed.
So you didn't know there were 2 8 o'clocks, huh?
No, you had an earlier one today. Where did you just come from?
We did a phoner from the hotel. Yeah, exactly. You know, life is, you know, we're out, you know, out in the weeds talking about something that's basically a labor of love, you know, that the concept that recovery is not just for addicts. I'm 24 years sober. My life got better. How can we pass it on to everybody?
Really? And you lived a life of excess. We can say that, can't we?
Absolutely. I like to think I have a black belt in whoops. Ooh, no.
But I think that's part of the first thing. I've been reading this. I'm halfway through this. I think by, you know, midday tomorrow I'll be done. I'm hoping. I'm really hoping.
And you're giving up your worst habit.
I really hope so. You know, I think the biggest thing is for one to make that choice. To say, okay, today's that day.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
That's it.
And what was your day, Paul? Do you mind if I ask?
Yeah, March 15th, 1990. And March 15th, 1990, I woke up instead of coming to, you know. It was just, you know, and I mean, there's a lot of buzzwords, you know, things I've said again and again and again because they're true. I'm an alcoholic and an addict, which is like saying you're from New York, New York. I mean, I am an alcoholic and an addict. Alcohol made me feel big enough to deal with the rest of the world. Cocaine made me feel like I could shoot basketball for money. I just, you know, I loved it until I hated it, until it became my entire life. And you know you're an alcoholic when you misplace a decade. The 80s were gone for me, but the 90s, all of a sudden, I found a life that I couldn't have imagined. Tracy, who I knew, I mean, I met Tracy when I was a mess. I mean, I met Tracy in Robert Mitchum's bedroom. And she walked in and said something really nice. She said, you know, like, sweet. I love your music. Like, oh, nice. 22, you were maybe 21.
I was like a little fan, and I'd gone to see you at the amphitheater. And then I came in and I said, oh, Mr. Williams, you're so cool, and I love your music. And anyway,
and then he said,
yeah, well, as long as it helps you get laid.
It's
and
I
was like,
oh, my
okay,
God.
So much for childhood idols. I'm going to go listen to some George Benson now.
And yeah.
And that was, you know, then 20 years later, we reconnected. And
Yeah.
And you're clean and nice and weren't saying rude things. And
yeah, she took a look at the two people and she chose the second one. She said, that's somebody that I can be friends with and all, because the other one was just an absolute little ass, you know. So as when we wanted to do something together, you know, when I was drinking and using, when Tracy first went to Hollywood, she went, you know, to had a meeting with ABC.
My story. Or, you're always taking my story.
Yeah, go ahead and tell that though. It's
well,
really
no, I did.
One.
I was a screenwriter, and I'm actually. Anyway, I guess we should say I'm not an addict or an alcoholic.
No, like but you're no stranger to addiction.
No.
I mean, credit card. Online stuff, all that stuff, you deal with it a lot in talking about it.
And I think we're, and that's, you know, because you've read it, that's the premise of the book. But I've always had, I think, sort of addiction envy. Not addiction envy, but recovery envy. And I've always really honored and liked my friends who were in recovery. They've been some of my favorite people. But Paul wants me to tell the other story, so we can. Oh, yes, this is cool. You're cool. We can just bounce around. So when I went to Hollywood, I was a screenwriter and a TV writer, and I had a deal at Sony. And I'd remembered Paul. There's something about Paul I just always really liked. And I went in there, and they said, "Who do you want to work with?" I know, you have a big ego.
Big
yeah, that's all he
now.
Needs.
We've
to
always liked Paul.
Yeah,
so.
We've always just liked Paul. So I went in, and people said, "You know, who do you want to work with?" And like, I picked two people. Okay, Alex Rocco. Nobody probably remembers Alex Rocco. Sorry, Alex. And I said, "I want to do a show with Paul Williams." And they looked at me and they said, "Well, if you load the truck of cocaine back under the lot, maybe you can do it." and that was, I guess, a hard no. And we didn't get to do the show.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, so now we have our show.
And that would be a gift, because if you'd done the show with me, we wouldn't be here today,
well,
because
you
never would speak to me.
I would have been executive producer and fired you.
You would have hated me.
Oh, been awful.
You would have hated me.
But you've always been a kind of, like you said, you've always looked at these methods of recovery, these other programs, like you said. I think you call it the beginning of the phone book, right? I don't want to steal your thunder.
Yeah, yeah, though. No, no. My life was saved by a group of people that belonged to a traditional recovery organization that I don't mention by name, but they gave me my life back.
And that's great. And then you've always seen that method of recovery, Tracy, and you've gone, wow. How can one implement this in their own lives for just things that are not just, you know, alcohol and drugs?
Yeah.
And well, yeah, the concept, you think, if it works for something as life-threatening and detrimental and ingrained and a disease, alcoholism at its core is a disease. If it works for them, why can't it just work for you if you're just a normal, everyday screw-up like most of us? And we are all just normal, everyday screw-ups at some point. At some place in our lives, something's a kilter. I don't know anybody, you know, who can walk in a room and go, I got it all together. So it just always seemed to me if we lived our lives with responsibility, taking care of our mistakes when we made them, making a daily inventory, just those very basic principles in recovery movement, wouldn't everybody be nicer and get along better? And wouldn't we all sort of get more out of life that we wanted?
Yeah, I mean, I'm at that part in the reading here, is that where I've already made at least a couple lists.
Awesome! Oh, we love that, Paul! High five, Paul!
All right.
Good!
Yeah, low five, Paul.
Paul, low five. Anything with me, I'm 6'6", so yeah, anything is a low five with you, baby. I'm telling you right now. But I'm making my list, and it's not just the good, not just the bad things, it's the good things, too.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
important. That's really good. That's awesome that you did that.
And then I'm trying to correlate how things have gone wrong, but I can't. And now I'm starting to get, I've already also made a list, starting last night, of amend. So I'm really trying to find those people in
yeah,
my life
yeah.
and trying to make that amends with them.
You know, to me, one of my favorite my favorite affirmation is probably, I will learn from my mistakes and not defend them. I mean, when you get to that point where you're going through this process and you go, whoa, you own your mistakes, and we help you do that in the book. We have a nice long laundry list of screw ups and things that you know you can kind of identify yourself, whether you're the meddler, a bet meddler, or somebody that's always
the bet meddler, yeah.
always meddling, you know, solving everybody else's problems, but their life is on a screw up. Any porn in a storm, if you cannot, you know, if you find yourself, no matter what you're doing, you go in the room, you lock the door, and you go return to SwedishFlyGirls.com, or
which
whatever.
It's not a site, ladies and gentlemen.
It's not a site. I made it up, but you know what?
They're all Googling it.
It gets such
yeah,
a
I saw a couple of those, and I'm like, I haven't heard of that one.
Yeah, yeah, I know. You know what? We may have to start that one. It's getting such a solid response from
everybody. We'll do better than with the book. Can you imagine? Gratitude just, and Trust and SwedishFlyGirls.com.
No, I will just go a link right back here. Yeah, that's where it should do is a link right back to the book.
Right.
That would be smart.
That's
that would
cool.
be smart. Yeah, because you know, your habits will take you away from real life. And these affirmations will take you back to a life. And they're huge hunks of most people's lives that are slowly revealed to them once they get past the distractions. You know, and if you have really destructive behavior like I did, those distractions can kill you.
And those distractions are so subtle sometimes. They just come right on you.
And you don't even know. You know, yeah. And people, and the thing that most people do is they play the victim.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so there's my role. Thank you.
Really?
Yeah.
Or me.
So I nailed
or
you
me.
Just like that. I couldn't tell. But most people, no matter what their thing is they're the victim. It's everybody's fault but their own.
Right.
And the truth is, stuff happens, okay? Stuff's going to happen to all of us, and that you can't avoid. But everyone really wants to pass the buck to someone else. It's mom's fault. It's dad's fault.
Right.
It's the boss's fault. It's, you know, the weather's fault. It's the economy's fault. It's the fact that, you name it. And it just doesn't work.
And you teach us about, forget the accepting. Let's accept it.
Yeah.
And it's just own it, like you had said.
And the fact is, if it is somebody else's fault, you know, and you can sit in there and stay in that hamster wheel of going, blaming them forever. Or you can say, I can change the way that I relate to this particular person or this situation. The first affirmation is something needs to change, and it's probably me. It's probably me. And, you know, if you've got that brother-in-law that is just impossible to deal with and he's not going to change and he's an ass and that's the way it is and all, the fact is he's not going to change, but you can unplug that, you know, and
that frustration and that all that
put
stuff.
An end to that relationship,
or just the way you respond. I mean, you know, we all know, and I mean, there's not a personal. We all have people who can push our buttons,
right?
Yeah. Some you can't escape from.
Some you can't. Maybe mom can push your buttons. Who knows? But you know, everyone can push your buttons, and right. You push them back, and you get a language. You know, you say she could. You know, you can give one look. And all of a sudden, you just know there's 150 statements in that look. And yep. You respond in the way that you've responded maybe since you were 4 years old. You can change that. You know what I mean? And that's the thing that people don't get. You don't have to always go back to that place you've always gone
to. Isn't that the definition of insanity, that we keep doing these things over and over again?
Or
and
addiction. Then different results.
It could be insanity.
Exactly.
But it could be addiction. You know, you can say insanity, or it can just be you're addicted. You're just addicted to that way of being in the world.
Picking
you don't
the
know any
guy,
other way of being.
Girl.
You know, I don't know that it's insanity. I would hate to sort of label it something so big as insanity, but I do think we become addicted and used to these really destructive habitual forms of behavior.
Yeah, I agree.
And that can be anything from cigarettes to porn to just, you know, we have a chapter in the book called When You Get to the Fork in the Road, You Take the Knife.
And plunge it in your chest.
And it's for all the people who self-sabotage. You know, you get option A, option B, option A is cool, option B sucks, and you go option B. I mean, in my heyday, my big thing was guys. You know, I didn't do drugs, but I mean, I could walk in a room with 20 great guys. I would just beeline to Mister. I'm going to break your heart and stomp all over you and make you feel like crap.
Right.
That would be what I would do for 20 years. I mean, it took me to be 40 before I had
my heart just totally. No,
you know?
I feel you.
And there are a lot of people out there that do that. They
right.
just go for the bad relationship. So
I'm a magnet. I want to save people.
People
I've been
pleaser.
Writing codependent anthems my entire life, you know, ouch mommy songs. I keep looking for somebody to fix me. You know, you find somebody, it's going to be, we're going to have a completely beautiful whole relationship. You're going to be a complete person. I'm going to sit here and try to live through you. That's part of my disease. I had to deal with that.
But isn't
pleasers.
That the greatest grand distraction? I'm so sorry. But isn't that the grand distraction? Us distracting ourselves with things like, yeah. I need to save this person instead of working on myself.
I don't know if it's a distraction. It can be a distraction, or is the way we learn to behave from childhood. Mm. I mean, I know in my case, I had a really bad father, and I still have a bad father. And I learned about how to relate to men through that primary relationship. So in every bad relationship I had, I was fixing the primary relationship.
Right.
And I think that people have bad relationships in their lives, and they have dysfunctional relationships in their lives, and they go back, and they're in fixing a new one, you're fixing the past. So in a way, I think that it's more that oftentimes, and I think it becomes ingrained in you, and you can't get out of the cog of that wheel. I'm going to find this person, I'm going to fix them, and that means I was a good person after all, and I am a good person, and I'm worthy of love because I took this person who's virtually impossible to deal with and I turned them around. You know, and we become people pleasers in that. And I think another side, part of that is Oprah had this great line of the disease to please, which I quite like. Disease to please.
Really?
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, I know that I suffer from that. You know, I'm always going to be like the good person and make it all right for everybody. And sometimes within that, we're not making it right for ourselves because we're just, then the insanity comes in if you keep picking the person that's completely crazy and you can't identify it. And that becomes something else again.
And see, I'm one of those things, I'm one of those performers that's always on even when I'm not on stage.
Yeah.
And so that's always like a pressure.
So you're in the room next to the real emotion. What's really going on in the center of your chest is over in the next room over there, but you're out there and taking care of the
people around
you.
Yeah, but funny separates us from our pain, too.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, funny is the big funny really is a firewall for pain oftentimes.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Because that was my thing. I was always the comedy writer, and then it was like, oh yeah, I could be funny about everything that was really hurting because
it's real.
It's easier than actually looking at in the eye.
I think that's
and then we don't not want to be funny. Then there's that whole horrible thing, like if we lose this, will we not be funny? And if we make our careers being funny, oh my God, we're getting into such heavy territory here, Paul.
But you know what the funny thing, though, is the funny thing. The odd thing is that as a transitional tool, I understand why it works. I understand why, you know, you're hurting so much, you learn to be funny, and it gives you relief. So in balance, as a transitional tool, it's something that was important to your life, and it was healthy. You know, it was absolutely
Absolutely.
Hey, it's like me
it's
doing
really
short,
close to sex.
It's me doing short jokes. It's the same thing. It's like, you know, make fun. I'll make fun of myself before somebody else does. And people laugh. All of a sudden, I've got a life in that. That's part of my stage persona, whatever. So it's a transitional tool. But what at a certain point, it becomes the total distraction where you're really not dealing with what needs to be dealt with. What's really going on in the center of your chest?
Yeah, no, it is, and it is off to, you know, at, what is it, 12 degrees off. You know, it's just a little bit off. It's in that next room.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't even imagine. See, I deal with a lot less stress when I perform. I'm not performing with, you know, Johnny Carson to the side of me and an audience of millions at that point. Yeah. But you had to be on it all the time.
Well, I think that part of my drinking and using was, do I really belong here? I mean, I had an Oscar on my piano. I had a star on Hollywood Boulevard, and I think at some level I wondered if I deserved any of it. You know, I had been so different. When I got out of high school, I was 4'6". I didn't hit puberty. They'd give me shots to make me grow, so I didn't hit puberty until I was like 20. You know, so I was this oddity. I was this weird little guy who tried to be an actor playing kids. I looked like a kid till you put me next to a real kid. Then I looked like a kid with a hangover.
Right.
You know? So I was different. Different's terribly difficult and painful and hard. I felt none of it. Before I drank alcoholically, I acted alcoholically. I did not feel that intense sadness at all. But when all of a sudden I'm doing, you know, 48 Tonight shows and getting all that attention, I've gone from different to special, and special was addicting for me.
Right.
But it also took me past the real emotion, what I was feeling, took me one step past it to the other side, that room on the other side of the pain. You got to deal with the pain at some point to grow up.
Yeah, you were mentioning when you grew up, they gave you hormone shots that actually stunted. They did the adverse effect. They stunted your growth.
Stopped my growth.
But they kicked in your hormones. Like, all of a sudden, your hormones are raging.
I hit puberty at 9. Instead of being interested in the toy box, you know, the toy chest, I was interested in my mom's friend's chest, you know. Which doesn't really work with the phrase toy box. I'm glad I backed out of that quickly.
Well, I was wondering how you were going to back out of that one.
It's okay. We'll take care of that in post, right, guys?
Back away quickly. Back away quickly. Mom's in the room. Back away quickly.
Hey, San Francisco. Come on. Yeah. Everything.
But yeah, you deal with the distractions. You get away from that, and you can finally deal with what's really going on in your world and begin to really open yourself up to have real life begin to happen for you. And it's full. I mean, I couldn't have imagined the life I have today. I'm having a pretty impressive time right now, and a wonderful time. And I had no sense of just the connectedness to the people around me or the career, you know?
No, that's a beautiful thing. And, you know, that kind of reminds me of, you just did your documentary, Still Alive.
Yeah.
And that, thank you very much for doing that, because I know that was hard.
Yeah.
As a person in general, to let somebody into your life, and you let it all kind of show.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of archival footage of me just, you know, I mean, you know, there wasn't a camera in there for to watch me, you know, being so rude to Tracy, but there was certainly a camera there watching me, you know.
There will be next time.
Well, I won't be rude to you again, because I love you, you know. Okay. But she's the alpha author. I've learned more about this process and this creative process of writing, and just this walking this walk together for the last 2 years has been an interesting time of self-discovery for both of us.
Well, that's great. I want to take a little musical break, which we'll listen to something of yours. But I also want to talk about how you guys put this together. Now, I love this, because with your insight on stuff, Paul, and Tracy's humor that she brings to it, it's such a yin and yang. It's such a good mesh. It's such an easy read.
Thank you.
And sometimes you're like going, wait, hold on, like. You know, we've talked about, you know, the method of recoveries in there. We've talked about some of the other types of addiction that's in there. But it, it's You even touch on faith a little bit, which, you know, a lot of people are not willing to make that leap. But you also say it's okay.
You don't need to make that leap.
Yeah. You just have to look at your life or look at others' lives and see some of the miraculous things that have happened in their lives.
There's a pretty good chance that faith will come to you, you know. But, right. but yeah, we can talk about that after your musical break. What are you going to play?
I don't know. That's a good question. You know what? I'm going to play an old-fashioned love song.
There you go.
So tell us a little bit about that when you wrote that.
Okay, I will.
All right.
Just an old-fashioned love song playing on the radio, and wrapped around the music is the sound of someone promising they'll never go. You'll swear you've heard it before as it slowly rambles on and on. No need in bringing them back, cause they've never really gone. Just an old-fashioned love song coming down in three-part harmony. Just an old-fashioned love song, one I'm sure they wrote for you and me. Weave our dreams upon and listen to each evening when the lights are low, to underscore our love affair with tenderness and feelings that we've come to know. You'll swear you've heard it before as it slowly rambles on and on. No need in bringing them back, cause they've never really gone. Just an old-fashioned love song coming down in three-part harmony. One I'm sure they wrote for you and me.
We're back here live in studio. Old-fashioned love song. You that is nostalgic for you, right?
Well, you know what? It's great. I mean, it's, you know, I had three hits with Three Dog Night. They were really, really good to me. And you know, it was just the whole songwriting thing changed my life as an out-of-work actor. I started, you know, writing down what was in the center of my chest basically as therapy. And all of a sudden, I had a career. You know, again, Noah's a gift. I didn't get the career I wanted as an actor. I got the career I wanted as a songwriter.
And it's funny because even that was a little off from center too for you, wasn't it? Because didn't you go out to write the big rock anthem?
I wanted to write the rock anthem. I mean, my biggest hit in the '70s, the first huge one was "We've Only Just Begun," which had all the romantic beginnings of a bank commercial. The time in a Gata De Vida was the number one album. You know, so. So I wrote this bank commercial with Roger Nichols. We finished it as a song. The only reason we actually did it is because they gave us a little creative fee and all. But I was like, I don't want to write a bank commercial. I want to be on the radio. I'm not going to be on the radio with a bank commercial. But an angel sang it, and all of a sudden, it was a monster hit.
Yeah, exactly. Karen Carpenter, right there. So, yeah, I mean, and I think it was Richard that actually heard it on the Crocker Bank commercial,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, heard the bank commercial called, said, is there a full song? And if there hadn't been, I'd have lied through my teeth and said, of course there is. We'd have finished it the next day.
I hope he took out an account with Crocker Bank, though, at the same time.
Say again?
I hope he took out an account with Crocker Bank at the same time.
I didn't. I think I went out and bought a Bugatti is what I did instead of putting the money in a bank. You know, some things never change.
Well, that's good. Now, we were just listening to an old-fashioned love song, and you were talking about the three different songs that you did with Three Dog Night. But, again, that road to, like you said, being special,
yeah,
led to excess.
Total excess, you know. It's just, you know, and before I was right, I mean, I'm talking about back when I was a little kid, feeling all that, not feeling all those emotions, but probably in the early '60s, I discovered amphetamines.
Really?
And you know that the mood lift, you know, diet pills that just went, whoa, wait a minute! All of a sudden, I didn't want to leave the room because I was afraid I'd miss what I was saying. Oh my God, I was just, you know. Euphoria, you know, and then I loved Euphoria. I was looking for Euphivia. I mean, let's take it higher and higher and higher, you know. So it advanced, and it's, you know, I don't know when I crossed the line from use to abuse to addiction, but somewhere along the line, as I added alcohol and a lot of cocaine and you know, and whatever I could get my hands on. I finally got to the point where my entire existence was about, I'd get up in the morning, I'd have a glass of vodka in the shower, I didn't leave the house. I was incapable of going to work or even taking a meeting. I was hiding.
Yeah, I mean, there's a fine line between confidence and maybe ego and addiction. I mean, with some things, I mean, I won't say power gets to you, but once you're starting to feel special.
Yeah.
I mean, you grew up in kind of a same similar situation as myself. I grew up with an alcoholic stepfather.
Sure.
And so I was definitely in the car when he was drunk multiple times or having a beer next
and
to you.
I wound up doing the same thing. But it's a progressive disease, you know. The thing is, it's a sneaky progressive disease.
And it doesn't just affect famous people either.
No.
I mean, I think we really have, you know, I mean, it's like, you know,
it's
the famous
everybody.
People get the attention, you know. But it's not, you don't have to be on Johnny Carson. You don't have to be, have a hit record. And you don't have to be, you know, you don't have to be any of those things. I mean, those are the ones we hear about.
Those are the ones that get the ink in the media and
but
stuff.
But if you crunch the numbers, they're not, it's so many people. It's how many kids. It's how many moms sitting home. It's how, it's a huge, it's a national problem. So it's like those get the attention. But in between, you look at all the people. And I don't know how much ego it is. It part of it's ego and just part of it's lack of ego and part of it's, fear. There's
fear-based,
so many things, and part of it's just the sickness.
So mine's a little bit of lack of self-esteem and actually depression.
Sure.
And so depression's huge part of it. You know, you're medicating yourself out of the depression.
Yeah, I'm self-medicating, so that wasn't.
That's a big thing. Self-medicating out of the depression. I mean, I was the reverse because I was the person who believed Reefer Madness. You know, I was like the one person who saw Reefer Madness in high school.
Right.
I get it. Gateway drug. I'll never get near it. And I literally never did.
See, and we just laughed and smoked a joint.
Right. Yeah. But I was one of those people, I would go to parties in L.A. with bowls of Coke. I could look like Scarface. And I would just go.
You just walk away from it.
I would walk away.
You were scared.
Well, it got you paranoid, right? It was like, get me out of the house. Get me out of the room.
I was so scared. I mean, I smoked maybe two joints in my life, and I was so convinced I was going to get arrested. I never did it again.
You so paranoid that
you're so paranoid. The cops are going to come. I had an agent who used to bring me Quaaludes. You know, he was trying to get me in bed, and he would be like, come to my house with Quaaludes. And I would just go put them in a jar, right? This is the 70s. When everyone wanted Quaaludes, I must have had 60 of these things.
Wow.
And some guy opened my medicine chest when I was at a party and went, oh, you got 60 ludes? I went, yeah. He goes, can I have them? I went, sure. He ran out of the house. He was so happy. You know,
it was like Christmas all over again.
Yeah. Guess how many ludes there are in this jar, and you can have them.
Think if you'd known me. That's right, God. Like the M&Ms.
Or the jelly beans in a jar. Yeah,
beans,
I love
right?
it.
How many ludes? But, you know, so it's... But I'm OCD. You know, I don't want to lose control.
Yeah.
We all do a different thing. Yeah. You know, we all have a different way of controlling our lives and controlling ourselves or medicating. And it's just...
Well, it's the illusion of control. Isn't it?
Because
and that's
totally
why the second affirmation of ours is really important, which is, I don't know how to do this, but something inside me does. That, in the essence, is... In the first affirmation, you're taking control by saying, I don't know, something needs to change.
And it's probably me.
Reservation. Yeah. And then the second one is, I don't know how to do this, but something inside me does. So you are taking control and you're handing it over.
And you're giving it faith. You're giving it faith.
Yeah. And that, and the balance of those two things, right? It's life in balance. And you don't ever want to say to people, you can never have another cookie. You can never have another pizza. You can never have sex. You know, all these things. I mean, we say in the book, I mean, addictions are fun. A lot of things people are addicted to are fun.
Right.
So it's a very
hard
thing.
They were at first,
you
anyway.
Know, they were certainly, you know, but, you know, sex is fun, food is good, you know, a glass of wine. You know, there are things that in balance are really, really fun. It's when that scale tips. So this is really about a life, and if you can get your life in balance, you can still enjoy things.
Well, like even you talk about a porn addiction on the internet. Now, well, there's one
huge.
That had, there's one that actually it gives a final payoff, if you will. So there's that pleasure component.
Oh, sure.
You know, it's
sure.
like cocaine or something. Yeah. There's that trigger in the brain. There's that endorphin that's released, right?
Sure, sure.
Well, now with smartphones, they're saying you get the same endorphin. I mean, phone addiction is probably one of the biggest addictions.
Geez.
And they're saying now you get the same rush, a kind of same dopamine rush.
By the way, he has a message.
Oh, he has a message. Will you share it with us? But you get the same dopamine rush when you go, oh, you know, so-and-so liked my post or so-and-so, that you do if you take a drug. So kids, like I have a 14-year-old kid, they're like, that's all they
can
do.
Well, they even have a little acronym. It's LMP, like my post. They want you to like it. Oh, I'm bored, like my post.
Yeah.
Am I nice?
Am I pretty? Yeah. Am I nice? Yeah. I mean, the whole self.
Well, am I enough? Am I enough?
How old's your daughter?
Yeah, looking for that excitement. Yeah, she's 18 now, and she's special needs, but I wouldn't know her unless she does have that ambient light glowing off her face.
Yeah.
And her arms in that, even when she doesn't have a phone, her arms in that crutch position. The poor girl. Yeah. So I think she's not, you know, they had used to have tennis elbow.
Yeah. I know.
Now it's going to be iPod. And,
oh, my 14-year-old takes a picture of sushi, and she comes and she goes, I got 97 likes for my tuna roll. You know, I'm like, whoa. But they're basing a lot of self-esteem on that. And
right.
That's
one of the most evolved people, right, I think, that we know, or some of that we're, you know, that we have a lot of respect for is Anne Lamott. And Anne Lamott, if you read her tweets and everything, she's talking about the fact she's now gone a week without tweeting while she's driving. I mean, it's interesting.
Safety. Now,
I do too. But think about the fact that she's so hooked into tweeting, or to texting rather, not tweeting, to texting. That, you know, so she has got, obviously, you know, and this is somebody who's, you know, put their life in order on a whole bunch of areas of their life and all, is still, you know, we all have something we need to work on. We've all got something.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so texting, yeah, she's addicted to it, to the point where she's doing it when she's driving, as she says, with the kids in the car. She said in one of her tweets that she had lied to Oprah about that she doesn't text when she drives. She said, I'm copping to it. I love that. I love that. I will learn from my mistakes and not defend them, which is one of our affirmations.
Well, when you see,
I don't tweet, but I do check messages at stoplights. I will admit that one. Okay.
Yeah, see, the only thing I do is, see, and I've curbed this, and it's funny, is because I try to check morning, then noon, then night. And if I can do that, if I can do my email, if I can do my social media, unless it's something like this where we're tweeting first, okay, everybody tweet, what's your handle? But that, I mean, that's about
the extent of it. But you don't go on 20 times a day checking stuff.
No, because I don't need to.
That's really good, though.
Right.
That's
impressive.
I need to work on that. Well,
I have a mild addiction to my iPhone.
Mild?
It's like, you know.
Really mild? That's how you're qualifying as a mild addiction?
Well, wait.
I would say you have an acute addiction.
Well, you haven't seen my full tilt addiction, you know. That's the one where I, you know, take it into the bathtub with me. And okay, I do take it in the bathtub. All right, maybe it's not mild.
So we went from vodka in the shower to your phone
in the bathtub.
iPhone in the bathtub.
Oh,
exactly.
Good. At least you chilled out. Yeah, you've relaxed over the years.
Yeah,
good.
A little bit.
a little bit of bath salts, a little aromatherapy. I see it now.
24 years of the most amazing life that I couldn't have imagined before. And
until you found your iPhone.
And you know, I'm working on it.
You guys are really happy, though. Both of you guys are really happy right now.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people will say, oh, you must have been so happy in those days. You just felt special and then isolated.
Well, I became better at showing off than showing up. I became totally addicted to the attention I was getting. So if you put down a couch and a television, I was there. I loved the attention. I loved how it made me feel. But that addiction was totally outrun by the other addiction, which was to the cocaine and the alcohol.
And you were just paranoid Pete. You didn't want anywhere near any of this stuff.
Well, the drug stuff?
Oh, yeah, the drug stuff.
No.
But you were at all into the relationship.
I was really into the relationship stuff. I was really
shopping.
I was into the guy stuff in a big way. I was into the shopping. I was into the negative thinking. We talk in here about reaching for a bottle of disappointment. I was definitely one of those people who, like, if I looked at the situation and I already saw the trouble. I would pre-disappoint myself before anybody could disappoint me.
Right.
Which, you know, so it led to a lot of broken friendships. It led to a lot of unhappiness on my part and a lot of isolation, a different kind of isolation and loneliness, but certainly a certain type of isolation and loneliness. And so, you know, I've always been moderate in certain things, but I don't think they're that different. You know, I think when you start looking at people's problems and breaking them down bit by bit and what propels them to do
it. It's the same process, right?
It's the exact same process. And I think, and one of the things that I think is very important in life is people get very hooked into, and the last book I wrote was about people being 50, women being 50 and having to change their lives, is being able to be adaptable in life. And I think that people get so hooked into one thing, that they're going to do one thing, they're going to be successful in one thing, they're going to be successful in this relationship, and the road signs might say, no, maybe it worked for a little while, maybe it's not, and they don't listen. They're just, and then they say they're stuck and they're unhappy, as opposed to actually being able to move. And
right.
Life is fluid and life changes, and you may not do the same thing at 30 that you're going to do at 50, and you might not have the same relationship at 35 that you're going to have at 55, and that's okay.
And thank goodness.
But people have to be able to adjust to that and see that and accept those changes in life, because life does move in a weird direction. And I think, I was a comedy writer for 20 years in Hollywood and had a great career. And then one day I didn't, which was like a complete flip out for me. Like, what was I going to do for the rest of my life? I'd always been this really good, you know, well-paid female comedy writer and then for films and TV, and I wasn't. And I thought, wow. I mean, I was sad for, 6 months. I'd go to my office and I would just, like, cry on my keyboard. So Apple was happy because I went through a lot of keyboards. But but I was really unhappy until I moved and I made a documentary and then I started writing books. And today I wouldn't, and I don't say this in this kind of Pollyanna, oh, sweet way, I wouldn't trade this for anything. I mean, to be able to do this today.
Right.
And if anyone had told me at
10 years ago you were doing this?
You're going to write a book about recovery? Me, really? The person who drinks a glass of rosé a night? I'm going to write a book about recovery? But it's been the greatest gift of my life. I mean, to get to do this and you know, we were just talking during the break. To have this book received by people such as yourself, which we have. We've had, like, really interesting, edgy radio personalities and just, you know, embrace this where you wouldn't really think you would, you know.
Right.
And to have people like you guys say, this is cool, I can use this, and to go out to the people who really need it and go, hey guys, it doesn't mean you're some wimp, you know. It's like, that is, you know, it's not just like having, let's say, you know, Katie Couric say, oh, this is the thing to do. Not to pick on you, Katie, you're great, but you know what I mean.
Oh, it's, yeah, like, she's listening, we just lost her.
Now you've done it.
But we've had a bunch of really edgy shock jocks and people like you who have really interesting radio shows that you know, that have a whole different.
We get it. We get it.
And we love it. And we thank you.
Oh, well, thank you.
And we thank you for getting
it.
No.
I'm the one that should be giving you my gratitude. Thank you guys for what you guys are doing, because it isn't just a recovery book.
Well, the nice thing about the addendum to that, you know, one really nice little moment right next to that is to sit down across from somebody who's got a lot of time, like a shock jock kind of edgy guy who's also got 17, 18 years of sobriety and is reading the book and turns to us and says, you know what, I'm not done with the book yet, but I'm already notating places because I'm going to go back through and use it as a workbook, because I'm discovering things that I have ignored that need to be dealt with. You know, this has been a great, this put turned the light on in areas of my life that really need some attention, and you've kind of shown me how to handle it. That's not something that I had imagined, and I'm not sure that, I don't know that Tracy had either, to where, you know, people that had really were so deeply involved in their own recovery would find that this was a great add-on.
Or the fact that you've already made, you know, notes, and you're making, you know, your lists. So
yeah, I actually want to highlight all over this book. I actually have a limited edition of the manuscript.
We'll send you a proper hardback sign.
Oh, thank you.
So you can, like, really mark it up.
Yes.
But I just want to take the highlighter to all this, because there's so many things that are just like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's just so simple. What is wrong? Why didn't I see that?
And then when you can pass it on to your kids, I think kids like my daughters, my 23-year-old really responded to this. And her friends, which is really interesting. So,
well, everything, like you said, social media, bullying. There's so many things that actually that tie into this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it's life-forming stuff.
And there are a couple chapters where there's one called The Ones You Love. You know, there's a chapter about dealing with if you have somebody that's stuck in their addiction, you know, whatever it is, it's really, you know, I think pretty intensive as far as some suggestions about how to deal with it. You know, how to deal with it to the point of getting them into rehab if that's part of it. You know, how to deal with somebody who refuses to change. You know, how do you adjust to that and all. There's another, our original chapter was called Dealing,
we loved it, Dealing with Dicks.
Dealing with Dicks. It's now called Navigating the Nasties, but Dealing with Dicks, we love the title, because sometimes in your life you're going to find yourself, you have detachable dicks and, you know, permanent dicks and temporary dicks.
That's right. You have the dicks you can take off and the strap on and the dicks that are there forever.
The dicks that are just like your boss is just an absolute creep, whatever. Like, how do you deal with that? How do you not buy into that relationship where you destroy yourself, you know, and lose the job over your reaction? How do you comfortably live with somebody that's just a pain in the butt?
Well, yeah, because there's those people you do have to deal with, right?
And that's life.
And then there's other people, like you were saying earlier, Paul, that we, you know, you maybe need to sever certain relationships.
Yeah, sometimes.
And you need to make that delineation yourself.
And it doesn't have to be acrimonious.
No.
You know, I mean, and there's people that I don't speak to anymore who aren't in my life. And I've even made amends to some of them. But it doesn't mean I necessarily want to have
hang
around
out with them
all the time.
Yeah.
All you can say is, you know what, I'm sorry if my behavior ever hurt you or I did anything to disrupt your life in any way. But that doesn't mean I'll have to go back to being besties with them. Yeah, that's not in the cards for me for a lot
of
people.
No, it's actually, that's you had to clear your piece. You had to be able to say your part.
And you were talking about the amends a little while ago, and I think we cut off and we went somewhere else. But it's a huge thing to be able to clear yourself of those relationships. It's like if you see someone across the room in a restaurant or a club or something, you go, yeah, you know, and you run the other way because you don't want to have to face them. It's like once you've cleaned it up, it's like it's not your problem anymore.
Right. It's kind of the etch-a-sketch to it. So.
Totally. That's a great metaphor. And they don't have, you know what? And you don't have to worry about it. And if they can't accept it, then that's their stuff.
Right.
But you know you did the right thing.
Right. No, and that's the thing. You're able to move on from that point. You know, maybe they're not ready to do that. Maybe you've hurt them so much. Maybe they're still stuck in their own situation. But that's not really your deal.
No. We change what we can, and that is the guy in the mirror.
Yeah.
You know.
Is that a Michael Jackson song?
I'm looking but the man in the mirror.
I love it. I love this. So do we have anything else? I know that you guys are doing this right now. Where are you going next? You're hitting the pavement everywhere. I just saw you on Adam Carolla. You did Oprah.
We did Oprah. We're Super Soul Sunday on November 16th.
Tonight
we are at a great good place for books in Oakland.
Ooh.
At 7 p.m. in the Presbyterian Church. Tomorrow night we are at Book Passage in Corte Madera, 7 p.m. That's our Bay Area, our Bay Area tour, and then we head down to Oxford, Mississippi, to Square Books. Yeah, we're like the next 4 months. We're on the road, we need a bus. We need like a Partridge Family bus that says
exactly.
Gratitude and Trust on the side.
Yeah. How's this being away from your loved ones and your families?
Well, you're used to it.
Yeah, I'm on the road a lot more than you know. But for example, if like Friday when we finish up in Mississippi, my wife Mariana is going to be in Tennessee at a storytelling conference. So I'll spend the weekend with her there. Then you know I work for ASCAP. I'm president.
Yeah, we were going to talk about that too. But yeah,
so on Monday after spending the weekend, she'll be home with Glenn, who is incidentally an amazing man who set an extra. He set an extra place at the table for me. Mariana kind of got rid of it, setting, because I was gone so much in New York so much. But I'll fly to London for like 2 days,
and then join
Tracy again back in Nashville where we pick it up again.
I go out for like this is the longest stretch, but I've had a career where my kids are used to like I'm either home a whole lot, or then I'll go away for a couple weeks. But I'll go out for now. This is the longest stretch, 2 weeks. But for the rest of the tour, I'll go out for 5 days, 4 days, and then I'll go home for 10, 12, and then I'll go out for four. So I'm in and out, and there's always my oldest daughter's 23, my youngest is 14. She's starting to go out on Saturday night, so she's really asking me to do a lot of my touring on the weekends, so I'm not at home to find out when she gets home. She's like, what do you mean you're going to be home on Saturday night? I'm going to be home for Halloween. Aren't you excited?
No. Not at 14. They're just turning that corner,
right? I can't
wear
that half-naked Vampira outfit now. So, especially with a book, you have a finite amount of time that you really got to go out there and sell it. So you do, right. And you know, we're both hams, as I guess you might have figured out in the last 45 minutes. But we love doing this. You know, we love our product, and we love selling, and we love sharing what we want to say, and we love meeting people. So it's all a gift.
Well, you know what? And it's kind of like you talk about service.
Yeah.
Love and service. And you're providing that for us now. You understand that. You're not really – don't look at this as self-promotion.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You know, we enjoy it, but we also get that. We get the fact that, you know, and we're starting to get feedback. You know, we have a nice little growing family at gratitudeandtrust.com. Gratitudeandtrust.com. Tracy and I write regular blogs there. We have guest bloggers. And through the – how long have we been doing this? Like a year and a half now? 2 years now. And because we started with that while we were working on the book, and we're getting amazing feedback from the people that are writing in, responding to the blogs and the like, and now to the book, that you know this is a labor of love, but this was a chance to, you know, in recovery we get to keep the miracle by giving it away, and this is all of a sudden it's like we've stepped out of one room and into the world and gone, okay, here's a chance for Tracy and I to give this in a whole new voice, in a whole new language, the basic concepts that saved my life.
And the one addiction we kind of didn't talk about in this, which I think is important, especially to readers, to listeners out there and readers, is food addiction is the number one addiction in America.
You know?
I mean, that one is, and all the people that write in, and we get a lot of letters every day, but even more than drugs and alcohol, the writers, more people write in about, I can't give up sugar, I can't give up food, food is ruining my life. And that seems to be in America, like the real... That's the big
mainstay.
Bad metaphor. The big enchilada is really is.
Did you did not
I
just
did
say that?
I did say
I love it.
It is.
Why she's the alpha author?
I mean, but it is the big, and it's hard. It is so hard for people, and there's so much shame, and there's so much pain, and there's just. It's a nightmare.
I'm sorry.
If I can just say one thing.
Yeah,
and,
please.
And this is a great plug for the book. Working the affirmations. I work the affirmations specifically around my weight. And about 2 years ago, my son said to me, Dad, you're starting to look like a cookie jar. Working the affirmations, and specifically the affirmations, I've lost 30 pounds and kept it off for two years.
Congratulations.
Give it up for Paul Williams.
You know, so, I mean, my sobriety came through, you know, a different traditional recovery process.
Recovered, but, and then you moved into Ben & Jerry's.
And then I'd go to Ben & Jerry's.
Well,
exactly.
See, okay, so then when you were mentioning food addiction, the first thing I thought about, Tracy, is there's also the people, which I'm definitely, because you guys have said so many things that resonate with me, but there's multiple addictions. If it's not, you know, like as a performer, my thing was like, okay, everybody's handing you a pill. It's always round.
Yeah.
Then you're drinking and compounding it. Then you already have depression and anxiety. Let's just throw that.
And you go to bed alone after the show.
You isolate yourself, or you have your partner right next to you, but you're still isolated from them, and you're pushing away in some way.
Yeah.
And so then if you're not chasing the food or the drink, it's kind of like a roulette, a Russian roulette of all these different habits.
And a lot of them feed into each other.
Oh yeah.
You know, so you're up late, you have, you know, you drink too much, you have a couple pills and it's 5 a.m. and then you go pig out on you know, it's like you just, there's not a balance. Again, it goes back to balance. And with people, and people eat, one of the biggest reasons people eat is out of sadness. There's no question. There's some hole they're filling with food. And one of the questions we ask in the book is, we don't care what you eat, but we care why you eat and when you eat. Because both of us have had weight problems. I used to weigh 35 pounds more than I weigh today.
There's a picture of us in the book.
And we've both, I mean, I struggled with weight for years. And, you know, it wasn't until I could just kind of let go of it and not be on a diet and not be totally focused on and not feel deprived all the time and not feel like I was substituting one thing for another, that I was actually able to lose weight. And I make the choice not to eat certain things, but I can eat them if I want to. Yeah. And that's a big deal. People flip out. They're all of a sudden on a diet. They're like, oh, I'm only going to have kale juice for the next 14 years. And they're like, yeah, sure, you're going to get depressed, and then you're probably going to go do something else. So it's but that's just one doesn't want to ignore, and that's a huge health hazard too.
So well, you're also telling people you don't have to do that. You don't have to give up something 100%.
No,
you know?
No,
not that.
We ate fries yesterday.
Oh, we had fries. We had
great
Jabba
fries.
Dogs.
Oh yeah, those were awesome fries.
Yeah. But what Tracy said, I think is really key. Not so much what you eat, but when you eat and why you eat. You know, for an entertainer, for me to, I had this actually a little couplet in the book that I said, like, it's like the cigarette that follows the ringing of the phone.
Yeah.
I get hungry when I realize I'm going to go to bed alone. I'd walk back into my hotel room after the gig, and I look at that empty bed. I get all that sadness, that ouch mommy stuff, and I'm headed for the minibar.
It's like the Pavlov's dog.
At any rate, it's exciting to see it that this stuff is
exciting and new, like the Love Boat.
Exciting and new, come aboard.
We'll get thin like you.
I don't know. We'll work on it later.
You both look great, so I'm glad that is working for you guys, and that you are doing this together, and it's the synergy that you guys bring. It's really cool to see you guys working together.
Best friend.
Best friend.
Best friend.
Yeah.
Let me. That's another song. I'm sorry.
Wow, you're just Nikki. And we're going to do a little musical break, and then we're going to say, because I know you guys got to get going. You got a full dance card, but we'll do a little bit of music. We'll come back, last minute plug, and say goodbye, and then
awesome.
We'll do our thing. All right. So we're going to do a little Daft Punk.
Yo.
All right. So here's the one. It's Touch, right?
You don't have to play all of it because it's 8 minutes long.
No, we're probably only going to play about half and then fade back in and talk, all right?
Sounds good.
All right, guys. I think we'll be back right after this. Sooner or later, this is what we'll do. Should.
Pictures came with touch, a painter in my mind. Tell me what you see. A tourist in a dream, a visitor, it seems. A half-forgotten song, where do I belong? Tell me what you see. I need something more. Kiss, suddenly alive. happiness arrive? Hunger like a storm, how do I begin? A room within a room, a door behind a door. Touch, where do you lead? I need something more. Tell me what you see, I need something more.
Little bit of touch there, Daft Punk with Paul Williams. Wow, I definitely got to listen to that album, Paul. I'm digging that so far, man.
Thank you so much. They're impressive.
They are, and then, so they reached out to you. You guys did this, and that was all because of your movie. They were good fans, right?
They were big fans of Phantom of the Paradise, which, you know, it was a well kept secret in the United States, but in France it was a big hit. In Winnipeg, Canada, and in Paris, France, two cities that discovered Phantom of the Paradise.
Yeah, and it's funny because when I started doing research for this interview, I was like, "Wow, why did I? How did I miss that?" But there's definitely there's that cult following.
It's really grown. It's really lovely to see. You know, you can't write something off as a failure too soon because 40 years later, it might get you a job.
Oh, there you go. And again, thank you for your service and doing this. I'm so grateful. Gratitude and trust, six affirmations that will change your life, Tracy. You're so funny. I definitely want to have you guys back again. I would love to work with you guys again. Love this. Paul, always a pleasure to talk
Great.
To you.
My pleasure, Paul.
Thank you very much. We're going to go into a little bit of a break, a little station identification, some bumpers. We'll be back. And then guess who I'm interviewing? Oh, my God. It's the greatest interview all day. It's going to be my mom.